You're listening to an RNIB Connect Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Toby Davey, and welcome to A Cultural Journey, bringing heritage to life through audio description for blind and partially sighted people here on RNIB Connect Radio, as you join me on a tour of HMS Belfast with Nigel Steele, one of the Imperial War Museum curators of Belfast. Throughout the tour with Nigel, you will also hear clips from the recorded audio described guide for HMS Belfast, which is available from the Visitor Centre for Blind and Partially Sighted People. As mentioned in the guide, due to the nature of the layout of HMS Belfast, it is strongly recommended to visit with a sighted companion to help navigate some areas of the ship. Before I step onto HMS Belfast and meet Nigel for my tour, here is part of the introduction from the recorded audio described guide, which I think gives a great overview of HMS Belfast.
Welcome to this audio described guide to HMS Belfast, London's unique warship experience. During its active life, HMS Belfast travelled 500,000 miles with a crew of up to 1,000 men who were on board for months at a time. So as well as being a warship, this was also their workplace and their home. Belfast lies in a specially deepened berth between London Bridge and Tower Bridge, a unique part of London's skyline. The ship is over 180 metres long. Stood on one end, it would be as tall as a building over 40 stories high. It's painted in its Second World War camouflage pattern with irregular blocks of pale blue, green and grey. It has four main gun turrets, two facing forwards at the front of the ship and two facing backwards over what's called the quarterdeck. Each turret has three powerful guns, and in between the guns are two funnels, which lean back at a slight angle. On the main outer deck is the ship's crane. Smaller guns are positioned along the ship's sides. These could be fired at a high angle and a rapid rate and proved to be particularly effective during the Korean War. Close to the front of the ship is a tower known as the superstructure, which houses the bridge from which the captain commanded his ship. Smaller anti-aircraft guns, known as Bofors guns, are mounted either side of the superstructure.
You join me here on RNIB Connect Radio on the quarterdeck of HMS Belfast at her mooring on the south side of the River Thames in London, fairly close to Tower Bridge. And I'm going to be going on a tour of HMS Belfast with Nigel Steele, who's the curator of Belfast. And we're going to find out a little bit about her history and what life was like for the sailors who served on Belfast during her active service. Nigel, firstly, tell me a little bit about the history of HMS Belfast, because I believe she covered almost 500,000 miles during her active service of 21 years before she came to rest here on the Thames in 1971.
Yes, that's right. Belfast is a very interesting ship. She is here principally because she survived. So she's a big survivor of all sorts of episodes and history, and really a period in reserve, which meant that in 1967 she was available, and from that time it took till 1971 to get the ship here. But what's interesting is that as well as the Second World War, Belfast has a very interesting service in Asian waters after 1945, which puts her in exactly the right place for the Korean War, but she continues that up until the early 1960s. And so that's why over the course of that 21, 25 years, she clocks up so many miles and does a complete circumnavigation of the globe. And it's good for the nation that we have a ship that has been preserved here in London with such an interesting history, because it allows us to talk about an awful lot more than D-Day and the Arctic convoys, which is often where people get stuck. But there is so much more to say that hopefully we can cover all of that today.
And one thing, as we stand here on the quarterdeck, behind us, aft of the boat, is her white ensign, which is one of the two flags which we'll probably talk about during our tour. But she was given permission to fly the white ensign, because I believe that's only flown on active warships.
Yeah, it's a very special thing for HMS Belfast and for the Imperial War Museum, is that the white ensign is normally only flown on a commissioned warship of His Majesty's Navy. But because Belfast is here to commemorate that link with the Navy and make sure that people remember the tens and hundreds of thousands of men who've served in the Royal Navy for the last 100 years or so, we were given special permission, Imperial War Museum in 1978 and the HMS Belfast Trust in 1971, to fly the White Ensign. And so it flies proudly from the rear of the ship. And there's a good story which shows how important it is, that when the ship was first commissioned on the 5th of August 1939, the Red Ensign was being flown. It first had to come down before the White Ensign could go up, but the Red Ensign got stuck. So they had to get a chief petty officer to shimmy up the flagpole, unfurl the flag, so that it could be brought down and the White Ensign raised in its place. And it's flown there ever since. And we're very proud that it allows us to make this special link, because it really is a distinctive mark for HMS Belfast.
And in front of us, we have a circular structure, which is part of one of the gun turrets. And hanging in the centre of it is the ship's bell. And the ship's bell on HMS Belfast was used for not only for alerting sailors to the time of the day, but it was also used for other alerts, wasn't it?
Yeah, the bell itself is solid silver. And it was a gift from the Lord Mayor of Belfast to the ship, because the ship was built in Belfast, obviously named after the city. And so the Lord Mayor wanted to perpetuate this link, and he offered the silver bell as a gift, but it didn't arrive on the ship until 1948. And what's interesting is, if inside the bell you can see a series of names, and the names are engraved on the inside of the bell, because you can upturn the bell, fill it with water, and use it as a font for christening babies. And these are the names of children who've been christened inside HMS Belfast Bell. And so it's a very special thing, and we don't ring it very often. And so when we get to ring it, it's a special thing. We're hoping that we can arrange this for you today.
So let's now explore a little bit of what life was like for the sailors working and living on Belfast. And obviously Belfast, you know, it's a ship and it's a living ship, and there's a galley on Belfast, there's the kitchens, there's a bakery, there's a butcher's, there's a chapel and everything else, and even a sick bay area with a dentist area and an operating theatre. But one of the places I think we should go and visit first is the torpedo flat, and the flat is the corridor on board a ship. So let's go and have a look at the torpedo flat.
Okay.
We're standing at one end of a long corridor. A corridor in a ship is known as a flat. Like all the internal spaces on board, nothing is regular or symmetrical, with air ducts, pillars, and pipes making navigation tricky, even at walking pace. Imagine what it must have been like in an emergency, with hundreds of sailors running to their action stations. This is the torpedo flat, where the torpedo firing tubes once stood. There's a white painted metal wall to the right of the flat, punctuated with steel uprights. On the floor against this wall is a torpedo, pointing forwards with its tail fins towards us. You can touch its sleek grey metal case, which is over 7 metres long. During the Second World War, HMS Belfast was armed with 6 torpedoes like this one. At that time, this part of the ship faced out over the seas. Instead of the wall to the right, columns held up the deck above with long gaps between them exposed to the elements, like a veranda. The torpedo tubes, which once occupied the far end of this open space, could be swung out to face the sea, allowing the torpedoes to be fired off the side of the ship and into the water, so they could speed towards their targets. Torpedoes from Belfast helped to sink the German battleship Scharnhorst in December 1943. After the Korean War, Belfast was rebuilt for nuclear age warfare. This part of the ship was closed in, and the torpedo tubes taken away.
Okay, well, we're now on the torpedo flat. And Nigel, just explain to me why HMS Belfast had torpedoes and how they were launched from this flat, from this corridor that we're standing in.
Well, HMS Belfast was a cruiser, and one of the armaments that she carried was two sets of triple torpedo tubes, like many cruisers of that size. And that enabled ships to fire a torpedo at the enemy, but only from a distance, obviously, because they were a big ship, so they were very vulnerable. And so on port and aft and starboard side of HMS Belfast was a triple torpedo tube. Now, that is 3 tubes joined together in one mounting. And the way that it worked is that the mounting was just beyond where we were standing now, and it could be turned through 90 degrees. So it would normally run in parallel with the ship, but if you wanted to fire it, you would twist it through 90 degrees, point the torpedoes out across the sea, and then fire the torpedo into the sea, and it would be set on its track to find its target. And HMS Belfast only fired its torpedoes once at the Battle of North Cape at the German battlecruiser Scharnhorst. And the torpedo officer was very excited about this. He's a man called Andy Palmer. And Andy Palmer knew that he was rarely going to get the opportunity. And so he managed to put a little swastika on his torpedo mats because he'd fired up the Scharnhorst. But he reckoned that by the time his torpedo reached it, the ship had already sunk. So he didn't think his was the one that sank the ship. But nevertheless, he fired it in anger. So he was taking that mark on his torpedo tube.
And Nigel, this corridor that we're on is actually enclosed, but it wouldn't have been like this when Belfast was firing her torpedoes.
No, at the time of the Second World War, this was a totally different area. What it is now, it was enclosed in the 1950s for atomic and chemical warfare to make the ship airtight, basically, so you could pump air around it. And there's a lot of trunking up on the deckhead and the ceiling. But at that time, this was like a veranda. There were a series of pillars holding up the deck above. But when we were standing, if we were standing where we're standing at the moment, we would look right out across the ocean. And the reason for that is so that we could swing the torpedo tubes around and fire them off the edge of the ship.
And why did Belfast stop firing torpedoes?
Well, I think for a cruiser of this kind, the strategy of war and the tactics of engagement moved beyond torpedoes. They became more about missiles and it became more about helicopters. So by the 1950s, torpedoes were no longer necessary for the armament of a ship like this. And so in the refit, when the ship was rebuilt for chemical and biological warfare, the torpedo tubes were completely vanished. But if we could lift the lino covering that we're standing on, you would still see underneath it the ring where the torpedo tube stood, almost exactly where we're standing.
Wow, fantastic. Well, we're now going to carry on and we're going to probably experience some of the sort of, I suppose, living areas, the galley, the kitchen, and but also Belfast had a chapel. So should we go and have a look at the chapel next?
Yeah, let's go there.
The chapel has a wooden door with glass panels at chest height. It looks into a small room with a warm wooden interior. The altar, at the back of the room, has a silver cross and candlesticks on top. Three simple wooden pews facing the altar can each accommodate four or five people. Standing to the left of the altar is a large golden lectern, topped by an eagle with outspread wings. Large poppy wreaths rest on the deck or floor in front. The metal ceiling is softened by ceiling lights with teardrop frosted glass shades. Just inside the door on the left is a brass Roll of Honour plaque. It's engraved with the names of ship's crew who died while serving in the ship during its 25-year service. Remarkably, there were only four. Next to the Roll of Honour plaque, in a wall-mounted Perspex box, is one of the ceramic poppies from the commemorative art installation in the moat of the Tower of London, Blood-Swept Lands and Seas of Red, which marked the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War.
Well, Nigel, we are now in front of the chapel on Belfast. And would the chapel have been used sort of weekly for Sunday services?
Yeah, this was the third chapel in HMS Belfast. And it was always popular with ship's company and for the crew itself. This is probably the most sophisticated one. And it was allowed because the space had a proper function when the ship was on active service. It was the third transmitting station, which is where they could set up all the electronic signalling equipment. So really, it wasn't a question of allowing religious services as creating a space that could be the transmitting station in an emergency. But it's a beautiful space, and it was used for regular services, and still is a place where there is a font inside, and there's a lectern in the shape of a large eagle. And it's a place that today we would use the fittings. We would often take it to the quarterdeck, say, for the Remembrance Day services. So it's still part of active worship and services, even so many years after Belfast went into reserve.
Because it has an altar and it has the crucifix and everything else and some wonderful sort of, I suppose, silverware as well.
The other interesting thing here is, as you would expect, often in churches and chapels, you'll find memorial plaques, brass plaques on the walls of the churches and so forth. And Belfast has a plaque just inside the door, very near where we're standing, which is a brass plaque commemorating the four men who lost their lives whilst serving in HMS Belfast. And what's remarkable is over the course of that 25 years of history, it was only four. And the first one was a man called Harry Stanton. And in November 1939, Belfast was very badly damaged by a huge mine that exploded underneath it. And Harry Stanton was the painter at the front of the ship, and he was thrown into this deckhead, the ceiling above, and so badly concussed that he died of his wounds a few days later. And then in Korea, three more lives were lost. Two Royal Marines, who were undertaking boats operations on the shore. And then the only person to die within the ship was leading steward Lau So, who was a man from Hong Kong who was one of the officer's servants and who used to serve at the table. And he was asleep in his hammock, and a shell, a North Korean shell, pierced the side of the ship, broke a steam pipe, and he was so badly scalded that he died in sick bay about 5 or 6 hours later. And it's quite remarkable that these are the only four fatal casualties from the ship's company over the course of that 25 years.
That's quite amazing, isn't it? And would the minister, would he also have been sort of, you know, a sailor as well?
Yes, he was one of the officers. He was part of the ship's company, definitely. They would have had him there for kind of religious comfort. He would have had another role. Every person who served in the ship, officer and rating, had a dual role. You had your watch role, but you would then also have your active service role. And so the chaplain would have had something that he would have to do when the ship went to action stations. And so he was certainly an integral part of the crew, like all of the officers were.
And I suppose for sort of Remembrance Sunday and very big services, they probably have a service out on deck.
For today, yes. Certainly every Remembrance weekend, we have a very nice service which is held up on the quarterdeck. And that is about the only time of the year where we regularly get to ring the bell. And we bring in, there's a company of sea cadets, the London Sea Cadets, who serve inboard the ship. And they come and they officiate and they help out. And it's a very, very nice service and a very nice day. And it fulfills part of the role that HMS Belfast has, is to make sure that we think about and remember those generations of men who have served in the Royal Navy, making Britain strong and prosperous.
And it's quite interesting that there's one of the poppies from the poppy display at the Tower of London in the chapel now as well.
There is. It's just next to the brass plaque commemorating those four lives that were actually lost. And it's another way of incorporating that sense of remembrance, which is symbolised by the poppy, into the chapel and keeping it current. And it's very much an active space, the chapel, I think.
And Nigel, I think there's a door in the chapel that goes into the sort of, I suppose, comms room or radio room where there was a radio station.
It's not quite a radio station. It's piped music, but it acted like a radio station. It was like the ship's own pirate radio station, certainly. And there, it was a place where you could send out messages across the whole of the ship, but also pipe music to the ship's company as they were working. Obviously not on active service, but when they were not on active service, what you can find inside are two turntables. And so a member of the ship's company would play records and pipe it through the ship, and they could send messages from home and relay signals. But also they could use the same equipment to do kind of radio plays. And they used to do comic sketches, which were broadcast across the ship to entertain people. So it's very much an integral part of the ship's company life. And so it sits there today, and visitors can understand that when we go through and we see the chapel and we see the sound reproduction room, like the radio station and the galley and so forth, Belfast is like a small city. It's like a town with all of these functions that you need to exist. There were 1,000 people living on board, and it was the kind of place that enabled you to find everything you wanted. You could be mended, you could put that together, you could eat, you could live, you could sleep, you could find entertainment. And that's all part of this one entity that is HMS Belfast.
Well, let's now move along, and I think we're going to probably go and visit the galley and the bakery and butchery and have a sense of what that area was like on board.
Great.
Nigel, we're now in a very important part of Belfast. We're close to the galley, the kitchen area, but we've got all these stalls in front of us. We've got the potato stall, but we've also got the butchers and bakers, which you can probably hear noises in the background. And this was, I suppose, a very busy area of the ship.
It was. I mean, they had to prepare well over 2,000 meals every day. And so there was a big galley kitchen for the ship's company. But also supporting that, there were 22 cooks working in the main galley. But there were also 6 bakers. But there were also 2 Royal Marine butchers. It was always traditionally part of the Royal Marine's role. And their job was to make sure that the frozen meat was always ready for the main galley and for the officers' galley. And so people would come down to what is behind us, which is the meat store, also known as the beef screen, and collect from the Royal Marine butchers the meat, the joints of meat that they wanted to cook that day. And so what you can hear is the ambient sounds put in by the Imperial War Museum of the butchers chopping up their meat. And directly beyond that is the potato store. And this is a large area which filled through a hatch in the deckhead, in the ceiling, with potatoes. And today you will hear often the cat meowing, because we have a figure of a cat inside to remind people that all of this food was a very tempting target for vermin and for mice. And so it was important to keep a ship's cat on board.
And how often would she sort of restock with all these sort of potatoes and meats and other foods?
They would do a big kind of replenish like that, probably whenever they went into port. So every few weeks they would fill up with fresh food. But they could do what was called a RAS. And a RAS stands for replenishment at sea. And that's where you run another replenishment ship alongside in parallel. And as you're both steaming forward across the ocean, you send the stores over from one ship to the other. And this was always a bit of a difficult task for people, keeping in station, but also just moving the food. So Belfast could be at sea for long periods of time. But obviously, the longer you were there, the less fresh food you had. But it did have big freezers in the centre of the ship, a couple of decks down from where we are. It had fresh food, which lasted as long as it could in terms of potatoes and vegetables. And it did its best to provide a varied diet for the ship's company. But what they liked best were the traditional kind of heavy, stodgy meals. So they liked stews, and they liked sausages, they liked gravy. And then for pudding, they liked things like plum and apple duff, which is like stewed plum and apple with a kind of crumble-like batter on top of it, with lots of custard. So this is a very physical life that these sailors live, and so they wanted hearty meals to fill them up. And the galley provided that twice a day, both at lunchtime, which is known as dinner, and for supper in a slightly smaller meal in the evening, and for tea. And there was always the possibility of getting yourself a cup of tea, or when it was cold, some chai, which is like cocoa. So you could get a cup of cocoa from the galley at all times.
And how many men would be sort of working in the galley?
The galley had 22 cooks and 6 bakers. Because Belfast was such a big ship, they had this independent separate bakery which cooked loaves, cakes, all day long. And they made so many that they could give it to the smaller ships like the destroyers that were moored alongside. And so that's always a testament to the size of HMS Belfast. But the ship's company would say it was always a lovely thing when they came into this area and came inside to smell the fresh bed cooking. And it's a fragrance that almost everybody likes and enjoys. And it used to float around this part of the ship and remind the sailors of home.
And it's very interesting that some of those sort of phrases that we use every day sort of come from living on board a ship, when you think of the square meal and stuff, because they had square plates. And when you think, because somebody on the fiddle, there was a sort of a ridge around the plate, wasn't there?
Yes, I mean, during the war itself, the sailors were eating in that kind of way, in a very traditional way, in a way that would have been recognised by the sailors that served under Nelson. And this was called broadside messing. And basically, all the men lived around a mess table, about 12, 15 men on one table. And every day, someone would be selected to come to the galley and collect the food for that 12 to 15 men and carry it back across the ship as it was pitching and tossing through the waves, carry it back to the table, they would eat it, and then they would bring it back and do the washing up. And that broadside messing, so eating at your mess deck, in your mess deck, at your table, carried on in HMS Belfast until the 1950s. But they found that cafeteria messing had been introduced by the Americans in their warships. And so to modernise HMS Belfast, from 1959 onwards, the ship's company would come en masse with a tray, go past a serving counter, and then would sit in one large dining room together. So it was quite a different experience.
And obviously drink was part of it, then people would have a sort of a rum ration, wouldn't they, or rum toddy, and we're going to probably go and have a look at the rum store in a moment, but that was very much part of life on board.
Yep, spirits up was definitely a popular part. It would be piped towards the end of the morning. And again, during broadside messing, someone would go from each mess with their large jar, which was known as a fanny, and they would collect all the rum in the fanny for the 9-12 people who were around the table and go back and split it up. Not everybody drank it, not everybody was old enough, not everybody was entitled to it. But they would take it back and give it to the members of their mess, and everybody would drink that every late part of every morning, just before dinner.
Well, let's have a look at the rum store, shall we?
Yeah. Okay.
So, Nigel, we did talk about the rum rations, and we are now in front of the rum store. I suppose this was kept very much a sort of guarded area.
Oh, yes. It was well and truly looked after and very strictly regulated. It was known as the provision issue room because not only the rum, but other provisions were issued from here. But the main thing that everybody knew it for was the big rum ration. And so every day, men would come from their mess deck with their fannies, their jars, to collect the rum as it was being issued. And it was usually, for the ship's company, watered down, and that became known as grog. So the grog was issued, and you got a set ration of every day for every man who was over the age of 21. So age over 20, 21 and over. And so it became a key part of the day, because they all looked forward to this. And it had been something that had been undertaken since Nelson's time and continued all the way into the 1970s, when it was judged that having people with a very strong rum issue every day was perhaps not the way modern health and safety allowed things to go on a warship.
Even though it was slightly watered down?
Even though it was watered down, I think you were still getting a hefty kick. But men got used to it, and it was an important part. And it originated because the water and the provisions were so poor on ships of Nelson's time that it was important to have this alcohol to cleanse them and keep them going. But it became a key part of the way of life for all sailors in the Royal Navy.
Well, we've now come into the sort of sick bay area, where we've also got the dentist chair, we've got an operating theatre, and obviously, yeah, most ships would have a sort of medical sick bay. But HMS Belfast, as I said, has a dentist chair and a full operating theatre.
Yeah, it's another testament to the size of HMS Belfast that it has this kind of high level of medical facilities. They had three surgeons on board, so that's three doctors, or two doctors and a dentist. And the dentist would double up as the anaesthetist if they needed to do one of the minor operations that they could do on board. And they then had further six berth attendants. So it was quite a big medical crew. And as part of that, you have this dental surgery with a full dental chair, just like everybody would know and love. And it enabled them to do dental work on the ship's company, which would have been very unusual for many of the working class men who were in the ship's company then to have got that level of dental care. But it meant that a fit ship was one that could fight better. And so it was felt to be a good investment by the Admiralty and the Royal Navy into the overall health of the ship. And it's the same with the sick bay, where they have a number of cots, and the cots literally are on rockers. So that if you undo the catches, they sway with the ship as it's going through the ocean. And you could be sent to sick bay and stay in there as an inpatient, or you could just visit sick bay almost like going to the surgery to see your GP. And the doctors and the sick berth attendants would hold surgeries, and they would attend to ailments and sicknesses. And then if it was something serious, like a broken bone, they did have this medical facility, the surgical facility, to fall back upon. And they could do things like setting broken limbs, or up to probably the level of an appendectomy.
Wow, it's incredible to think of that. And I think the sort of stretchers that they used on board are still sort of, that style and system is still used today.
Yes, there is a particular type of stretcher called a Neil Robertson stretcher, which was, I think, originally invented for use in mines, but used in ships as well. And basically, it's a platform with a bamboo curtain that can be tied around the casualty and then tightened up very fast, so that basically you become immobilized on the board, and then they can pass you up the ladders to get you out of the ship. And it's a way, if you were down in the bowels of the ship and you broke your leg or were badly wounded, that you could be manhandled through the hatches and up through the ladders in order to get you out. And it looks fairly brutal, but it's really clever, because it allows that injured person to be carried out of the way and taken back to sick bay or ashore to get full treatment.
And the surgeons were officers as well, like the people who worked in the galley?
Yes, there would have been a surgeon commander, the senior one, and a junior surgeon, a surgeon lieutenant, and the dentist, who would probably have been a surgeon lieutenant rank as well. And so they were important members of the ship's company. But one of the ancillary roles of the junior doctor, so the surgeon lieutenant, was also to be in charge of and monitor the officers' alcohol supplies. And pinned to the examination room is a chart from the junior surgeon, Tony Rowan, who was the surgeon lieutenant in Korea. And in amongst his papers, which are in the museum, is this graph showing the consumption of spirits by the officers in the wardroom. And it's quite interesting that it goes up significantly when they go into port, not because they drank more, but because they entertained.
Oh, that's a wonderful little anecdote. Let's move on.
As we step through the door, there's a second curved wall ahead, with some stainless steel lockers attached to it. To the left, the outer wall of the ship contains a number of scuttles. The wall angles away as it rises. Cupboards bolted to the walls contain white plates, bowls and cups, all kept in place with metal bars. Standing in front of this wall is a row of long dark wood tables with bench seats either side. These are the sailors' mess decks, still looking like they might have done in the 1940s and 50s. Sailors lived here in small groups of 8 to 12 men, known as a mess. Each mess focused on one of these four tables. Here the crew relaxed when not on duty, reading, writing letters, and playing cards, and before HMS Belfast had a cafeteria, eating their meals. At the end of every day, the tables were taken down and hammocks hung from black bars in the deckhead or ceiling. They were very close together, and you had to swing yourself up to get into them.
Well, Nigel, we're now in one of the mess deck areas of Belfast, and we have talked about this a little bit before, but actually standing in here, it does feel quite a sort of confined space.
It would have been very crowded. You would have had probably 20 to 30 men in each of the mess decks, and they would have lived, slept, relaxed, basically, in this space. This was their whole living environment. And so during the day, the hammocks would be slung, and you would get out the tables, and in front of us are a series of mess tables around which the 12 to 15 men of each mess would have lived. And so during the day, when you were not on watch, you could sit at the table, you could write letters, you could play games, you could do whatever recreation you fancied. And then in the evening, when it came time to sleep, the tables would be lifted, they'd be folded up, put behind the racks, which line the edge of the mess deck, and the hammocks would then be slung instead. And in the deckhead, the ceiling above us, there are a series of black bars. And from that, you would hang the hammock on one end and tie it to the other end so that it was long enough to stretch out. And all the men would live together. The difficult thing was if you had a watch in the middle of the night, was getting in and out of your hammock without waking everybody else up, because you wouldn't be popular if you did. But it was a very crowded space. You had very little privacy if you lived and worked in a warship, because everybody lived on top of each other. But nevertheless, as long as the ship's company got on together and worked well together, if it became a happy ship, then it was one in which people didn't mind too much and they quickly got used to it.
And I suppose we have got some audiovisual playing in the background, which is giving people an idea of the various places that Belfast went to. But where would this sort of, I suppose, the actual officers, would they have a separate mess?
The officers had a recreation space called the wardroom. That was like the officers' mess. And they had both a dining room and a bar where they could sit and get drinks and cocktails in the evening. But all the officers had their own individual cabins. Sometimes they were shared, but sometimes they were individual. The junior officers, they were quite small, but the more senior officers had some quite comfortable cabins with basically a sofa bed that could be pulled out and got ready by your steward. And then in the daytime, they would push the bed back so it became a sofa and keep the bed linen and the pillow underneath in a drawer and then bring it out again and make the bed for the evening. So it was a reasonably comfortable existence, but the officers lived separately in those areas. The ship's company all lived together in big mess decks like the one we're standing in.
And I suppose very difficult to find a place to sort of hide and have some time on your own, I suspect.
I would have thought it would have been almost impossible to hide anywhere. If you were feeling blue or fed up, someone would notice. But you would hope that they would then step up and help you and bring you together. And within a ship like HMS Belfast, which is always well commanded and was always, as we say, known as a happy ship, I think those sort of social welfare problems were quickly sorted out. And that would have been one of the roles of the chaplain that we've already talked about, to help men who were having trouble with separation from home, relationships breaking down, whatever. It happened because life went on. In among the 1,000 men living in the ship, there was always going to be issues going on with themselves, with home. And so it was part of the officer's job is to watch out for the men who directly worked underneath them, who they commanded, sometimes as big units, sometimes as small units, to make sure that they were all looking after themselves and their health and their welfare was good.
Well, we're now going to step outside again and we're going to go to the front of Belfast, the prow of Belfast, where her anchor is, but also where another flag is. So let's go out there.
Back outside, we're close to the front of the ship, where the grey metal deck narrows to a point, the prow. A massive grey anchor lies at the prow and huge chains, or cables, lie across the deck. wrapped around a triangular formation of three white-painted capstans. At the very front of the ship is a flag.
We've now come out onto the forecastle, which is the forward part of HMS Belfast. And, Nigel, in front of us we have a jackstay, and it's flying the other flag, which I did mention earlier on that there's two flags which we're going to talk about. And this is flying the Union Jack, and it's the Union flag, but it's called the Union Jack because it's flying from the jackstay, isn't it?
It is. We're always very keen to point out to people that when you visit the forecastle of HMS Belfast, you see a proper Union Jack, because the jackstaff, which is the flagpole at the front of a warship and large ships, is the only place where when the Union flag is flying on it, that technically you have a Union Jack. If we look behind us, we could see the court building flying a Union flag on its flagpole, but that's only a Union flag. But technically, the Union Jack is on the front of HMS Belfast, so we're always keen to point that out to people, and it's a very useful piece of pub trivia, which will probably win you the quiz one of those days by knowing that that's what a Union Jack really is.
And we've also got the anchor of Belfast as well, and all the capstans around us which would have wound up the anchor. And it's quite a large anchor.
It is. They're large and very heavy anchors. We've got two of the original three left, and the capstan could be used to raise the anchor mechanically. But if the capstan broke, they would do it the old-fashioned way, as you saw it done in Nelson, by putting lengths of wood, and then they would, each man would take a length of the wood. There would be about 10 of them around the capstan, and they would mechanically raise the anchor that way, so that if the mechanism broke down, you could still do it by hand. But it's a very important part of the ship, and you can see on the capstan, the one on the starboard side is painted green, and the one on the port side is painted red, to emphasise the different colours that are used in kind of naval signalling and for security, to make sure that people know which is the left and which is the right of the ship. And so that it's all part of this historic area. And the amazing thing when you come out here onto the forecastle is that when Belfast was doing things like the Arctic convoys, all of this were being covered under inches of ice.
Wow, wow. And I think all the sailors were made to come out with whatever they could find to get rid of the ice.
It was a constant job, making sure that the ship didn't completely freeze up. There would always be working parties out here, chipping off the ice from the deck. And from just immediately behind us is the forwardmost of the 6-inch gun turrets. And they constantly had to be moved to stop them from freezing up. And then you would have to knock the ice off the barrels in case you were suddenly called into action, and the gun had to be fired. You couldn't use it if it had been in that state, so you had to make sure that it was constantly being kept in a usable state. And it would be the same with the whole of the forecastle. And it is quite amazing, really, when you see the photographs of the working parties and the men out chipping the ice off all the time. And there's a great story that goes with this, is that there was one of the coppers in the galley constantly kept a stew going. And they would bring out a big Dixie, a big pan of stew, to the men who were working outside to warm them up. And the chief yeoman aboard the ship was once told that one of the veterans who came on board, who said that the chief cook had a pet monkey. And one day the pet monkey disappeared, and nobody knew quite where the monkey had gone. But constantly they were replenishing the copper with the stew on it. And when they got back to Scarpa Flow and finally drained it, there was the poor old skeleton of the monkey at the bottom of the copper. And so we always talk about the monkey stew for the men who were keeping the ice chipped off the side. We believe it's probably an apocryphal story, but it's a great story. And it was told direct to the chief yeoman many years ago by one of the veterans. So it's probably a sailor's tale. But nevertheless, it illustrates that need to constantly keep them well fed and warm whilst they were doing this very important work.
And behind us, Nigel, is the sort of superstructure of Belfast, which houses the captain's and the admiral's bridge. And I think to indicate whether there was an admiral on board, Belfast would have been known as a flagship, and she was a flagship, wasn't she?
Yes, Belfast was built as a flagship, and it was always expected that there would be an admiral on board for most of the time of Belfast service. And so it has that capacity, and it has the accommodation so that the admiral could come on board and command a small fleet or a small flotilla from inside HMS Belfast. And when an admiral comes on board a ship, they bring with them their flag. And so they fly their flag to indicate they're commanding from that vessel, and so the ship becomes a flagship. And throughout most of its life, Belfast was a flagship. And it was an important part of the Battle of North Cape, where Rear Admiral Robert Burnett took some important decisions about the cruiser flotilla that he was commanding. It happens in Korea, where the admiral there commands a Commonwealth fleet for ships from Australia, New Zealand, Canada, as well as the United Kingdom. And so all of that time, the admiral will have their own bridge, and directly above that is the captain's bridge. And today you see the captain's bridge, or the compass platform, because they have the main compass of the ship inside it, is inside. But for most of Belfast wartime service, the compass platform, the captain's bridge, was outside. And when you look at the superstructure, you see what today we'd call the flag deck. That was the original bridge. And so when Captain Robert Parham was commanding at D-Day and at the Battle of North Cape, that's where he took command. When Captain Sinclair Ford was commanding Korea, that's where they stood in the sun and the freezing cold of the winters, always outside, taking the command decisions because they could see forwards. But when the ship was enclosed for nuclear chemical warfare, the captain too had to come inside. So the admiral was shunted down a deck and the captain took their position at the top of the superstructure. And it's today it's a very interesting space because you can see all of the dials, the command positions, which will allow you to change the speed of the ship, to send a message to the helm, and so forth. From there, you would stand as the captain and basically operate full command of the ship.
And there's one more area of Belfast which we're going to explore, which is the boat deck, and we're going to just go there now.
Yes.
Well, we're now on what was known as the boat deck, but it was also known as the flight deck because Belfast also had airplanes which were launched from her decks as well. Nigel, why did she have airplanes?
Well, before they invented radar, for a capital ship like this, there was no other way really of finding out what was happening beyond the horizon other than to launch one of its seaplanes and for it to go off on its mission, come back and report as to what it could actually see far ahead. And so today it seems absolutely crazy that they had these folded wing aircraft that they could put together and launch off the side of the ship. But before radar was invented, there was no other way of doing it. After the mine explosion, Belfast came back into service in 1942, and radar had basically caught up technologically, and Belfast became equipped with some of the best radar in the fleet. And so from that point on, it very rarely ever used its seaplanes. But before that, it would have had to launch a plane in order to be able to see anything which was out of direct vision from the top of the superstructure, which is not a great distance that you can actually see. So it was a very important thing to do.
And the interesting thing that we also have on this boat deck, or the flight deck as it was, we have one of the cranes which was used for bringing the boats back on board.
Yes, today we've only got one crane left. During the war years, Belfast had two cranes, one on the port and one on the starboard, so that it could pick up the seaplane when it came back from either side of the ship. Because obviously they would manoeuvre the ship to try and get the best, most stable sea platform to pick it up and then bring it back onto the deck and put it back in the hangar. But when the flight deck was basically welded over and the catapult that launched the planes was removed, we retained only one crane. And that now sits in the centre, just behind the superstructure. But at the time of the war itself, there were two cranes, one on the port, one on the starboard, a little further aft in the ship.
Well, this is where my tour of HMS Belfast ends, but you can explore more of her using the recorded audio describe guide, and you can find out more about Belfast and the guide by visiting iwm.org.uk/visits/HMS-Belfast. Nigel, thank you so much indeed for giving me a wonderful tour of HMS Belfast and for telling me a little bit about her history and giving me an insight into what life was like for the Royal Navy sailors who lived and served on her during her active life.
That's great. It's been a real pleasure, and you're very welcome, and we're very welcome all your listeners anytime they want to come and visit.
So, Nigel, we're in front of HMS Belfast Ship's Bell. Nigel, what am I touching? Because I think that's the crest of Belfast.
That's right. What you found there is the badge of the city of Belfast. And on the top of the badge is a seahorse.
Oh, yeah.
And to one side. And it was from that badge that the ship took the emblem of the seahorse to be part of its own badge. And so it perpetuates that link between Belfast, the city, and Belfast, the ship that was built there, which continues to this day. And I think we'll also, the new HMS Belfast, which will be launched in 2026, 2027, will also continue that link as well and provide a historical continuity through our ship back to that original building of the ship in 1936 to 38.
Well, that's fantastic to hear that there will be a new HMS Belfast and that she will have a bell as well. And lots of noise of Thames behind us.
Thing you might be able to find is if you put your hand inside the rim.
Okay.
You can feel some of the names.
I can feel.
Those are the names of some of the children.
Wow.
Who've been christened inside the bell.
Wow.
And so they then have their names stamped with the date of the baptism.
That's an honour, and it would be an honour if you were one of those children and you came back sort of, you know, 20 years later or what have you, and sort of put your hand in here and found your name. Wow. And I think we're going to be very honoured to be able to ring the bell today. Is that something I can do?
It is, because the bell will be rung perpetually by every single visitor. We take the clapper out so that it stays silent, but today we're going to put the clapper back in so that you can ring the bell.
And the clapper's made of silver, isn't it?
The ball at the bottom of the clapper is a silver ball to match the silver bell.
What an honour that was to be able to ring HMS Belfast Ship's Bell. And thanks so much to Nigel for an amazing tour of Belfast too. If you are interested in military history and coming to London, I would certainly recommend visiting HMS Belfast and going on a tour around the ship using the recorded audio described guide. And probably a good idea to share the experience with a sighted companion, as there are some areas of Belfast that could be slightly tricky to navigate without some sighted assistance. To find out more about HMS Belfast and the recorded audio described guide, do visit iwm.org.uk/visits/HMS-Belfast. Well, thank you so much for joining me here on RNIB Connect Radio for a cultural journey and the tour of HMS Belfast with Nigel Steele, one of the Imperial War Museum curators of Belfast.
For more interviews, features and shows, go to your favourite podcast provider and search for RNIB Connect Radio.